Man and wife take to God the love which bears them toward Him. Love cooperated day by day in their salvation. They must work for the salvation of love. But little by little a change takes place. While at the beginning they go to God by the way of love, a day comes when it seems truer to say that they go by God to love. Or rather, their love is in God and there is no need to leave one for the other. Love is source of grace. God is already present to the heart of simple natural love, and those who search there will find Him. But in Christian homes, founded on the sacrament of marriage, His presence is infinitely more real and more efficacious. It is not love, properly speaking, which becomes a sacrament, it is the mutual promise and the union which follow it, but love, the inspiration of that promise, and the living soul of that union, participates in the sacrament. It may be said of love that it is not only sanctified but sanctifying. In all ages men have asked from love the sweetness and joy of life. They have asked everything from it, and yet they have not hoped enough in it. Christ came, and now love is capable of transmitting to men the divine life. Love, the cause of joy, has become the source of grace. Men have asked everything from it, it gives them more than everything, because it gives the cause of all, God. Married Christians turn to the sacraments and especially to the Eucharist, the greatest sacrament of all, to nourish their spiritual life. But why are they so often ignorant of the fact that grace is offered to them in the very heart of their love, in their very home where burns the inextinguishable flame of the sacrament of marriage? At the deepest level of their union, Jesus Christ waits to give Himself to them. Pope Pius I, to help us understand this mystery, invited us to compare the sacrament of marriage with the sacrament of the Eucharist. For this purpose he recalled the words of Cardinal Bellarmine: the sacrament of marriage can be thought of under two aspects, first, when it takes place, second, while it perdures after having been established. It is in fact a sacrament like the Eucharist, which is a sacrament not only at the moment when it is consecrated, but during the time it remains and as long as husband and wife live. Their society is always the sacrament of Christ and the Church encyclical Castae Cannubi. Love is never at rest. Christ did much for love, but He requires of couples that they not remain idle. Love, marvelously saved and called to the holiest of destinies, remains vulnerable and in danger. Christ did not give it the graces of immunity, but rather the graces of labor and combat, which assure it the strength to surmount temptations. Routine is not the least to be overcome, and to triumph over inner and outer enemies. A love which refuses labor and combat is a love defeated in advance. There is no peace for love save an armed peace. The most dangerous adversary of love is self-love. One hears married men and women say, "I expected much from love, but I was deceived." Often enough the truth is that they have deceived love, it is love which expected much of them. Love is proud, it does not give its joys or its grace to selfish hearts. To claim its riches without making any outlay on one's own part is to insult love's dignity. Those who come to it as beggars are rejected, those who give all receive all. He who saves his life loses it. He who consents to lose it, saves it. This teaching of Christ which formulates the great law of life is valid for love. But in married life it sometimes has a tragic side, there too are one, and the selfishness of one alone is enough to compromise their common work. Let us remember that Christ came to save love, but that He will not save it in spite of itself and without cooperation. He requires that love consent to its salvation, and that it bring to that work an alert intelligence and a tireless perseverance. Love and the Cross. A great love requires a great labor, it is not the work of a day, it is not an easy enterprise. It will know suffering, some through its own fault, some through the trials inherent in every human life. Let it accept them. The suffering will purify it and help it combat and overcome the germs of sin and of death which it contains. Love will be protected by the cross, as the houses of the Hebrews were by the blood of the Paschal Lamb on their door. the avenging angel will not enter. More than protection, the cross offers to love a new nobility. The cross is the touchstone which forces it to reveal its value. Either it will accede to a new nobility by transcending itself, or, disdaining that nobility, it will remain the more or less debased slave of selfishness and sensuality. True, there is in life a circle of radiant hours, there was even in the life of Christ, but the illusion of an easy and endless happiness is fatal for love. It is responsible for many failures of which we are the powerless witnesses. For those who enter into marriage without understanding that there is joy only beyond the mortification of all that indulgent selfishness introduced into the human heart by sin, fail inevitably. Because they have refused the cross, they will not enter into the best joys of love. While those who do not love truly turn away from the open arms of the cross, others see there the great opportunity offered to their love to affirm and strengthen itself. It is easy to love when all one's desires go with it, it is exalting to love when, for the joy of the other, self-sacrifice is required. This greatness of love was unknown before sin. On a path without obstacles, love had no need to surpass itself. Sin, by causing suffering, furnished this occasion, better, it gave to love the weapon with which to vanquish it. To expiate the sin which is the refusal of love, human love following the example of Christ will use suffering, the daughter of sin, and gain the glory of sacrifice. The Christian couple understands the cross. Love is praise of God. Like every creature, love is invited to sing the glory of God, for which it has been created. All works of the Lord bless the Lord. Here is a primary aspect of its vocation. But this obligation must not be misunderstood. It is not a question merely of reserving, in the Christian home, a time consecrated to prayer. God does not demand his part, he demands all. The whole life of love must be a praise of God. It is possible to think that among the praises of the earth, the Lord delights especially in those which Christian love offers to him, even as the artist, among his works, regards with special tenderness those in which he recognizes himself the most, where he has best expressed himself. Let those couples desirous of praising God make of their love a beautiful and shining work. It is true that the nuptials of God and the soul of the one consecrated to virginity are an even more precious praise in the eyes of the Lord. But it is precisely one of the glories of human nuptials to have furnished the image and to have been the source of these. Coventry Patmore has expressed it in an unforgettable sentence, "Married lives which do not betray the honor at the heart of love are fountains of virginity." But how many unions offend the God they are supposed to praise? That is the great scandal. In order to make reparation, those ever-growing number of Christian homes who have understood this do their utmost to love their love in all its natural and supernatural splendor. In addition to a praise of God, love must also be a message from God. The work testifies to the talent of the artist. A choral tells us something of the deep life of J.S. Bach. In the same way, creatures speak to us of the Creator, and reveal to us his thoughts and his perfections. The starry heavens speak of his knowledge, the ocean manifests his power, the clear gaze of a child lets us glimpse his purity. But love takes us into a deeper, more profound secret, infinitely more enriching for the human heart. It teaches us of the love which is in the heart of God. A great human love proves that love exists on the earth. And this is already a singularly important piece of news for many of our contemporaries who have lost faith in love, but especially it offers us an authentic image of the divine intimacy, of the love of the Father and the Son in the unity of the Holy Spirit. It proclaims that God is love. Human love is the reference which helps us to understand divine love. By its power to make two beings one, while safeguarding the personalities of each, love allows us to acquire an understanding of the mysterious union of Christ with humanity and of the spiritual marriage of the soul with God. Such is the message of God which conjugal love is charged with bearing to men. Its importance helps us estimate the value and the confidence that God gives to love. Love is in the service of the Father. Is not the desire of God to share His happiness and His life with many children in the ardent intimacy of the Trinitarian dwelling more comprehensible to us when we find a similar desire in our human homes? But it is not only a matter of comprehending the profound desire of the heart of God, we must listen to it. For the Creator has made love the irreplicable collaborator of His paternity. Through love of love, God has tied His hands. He will have no posterity except that which will be given to Him by the union of man and woman. And when narrow and greedy hearts make themselves deaf to His prayer, the great-hearted Father cannot discharge His tenderness. But when love leaves a large passage for love, God can shower His affection on many children. Spouses must seek to recognize the beating of the heart of God in that ardent desire for a child in the most intimate center of their love. God has confidence in you, have confidence in Him. He who promised not to leave without recompense a glass of water offered to a beggar, will He not shower abundant benedictions upon the homes which give Him many children? Words cannot worthily express the praise of love. It is the life of Christian spouses engaged in the magnificent adventure of love that can. People watch and listen for the testimony Christian couples have to give. The command of Christ, "You will be my witness," is especially addressed to the love of the Christian wife and husband. With the eyes of God. Someone has remarked that true love is not blind. It is rather its striking insight which makes it appear blind. It sees what no one else sees. It even sees beyond the beloved's gift of himself. The eyes of love see beyond mere appearances the radiant face of the saint that the beloved must become, and that he already is potentially. The eyes of love see the loved one as the Creator did. The vision of the Creator is a creative vision. To look upon and to create is one and the same act of God. His glance is not that of a spectator. He does not gaze at a being already existing, but he introduces and poses a being in existence. The glance of God conceives a man, a unique saint, and behold, that man exists. The artist is an earthly image of the Creator. His cathedral has to begin with an interior and creative vision. It is that vision become stone. Even if the execution betrays it, it is always through that first intuition that the artist sees his work. It happens sometimes that God communicates to us His vision of a being, and then we see with an astonishing clearness the true face of a child of God, more or less hidden in the flesh, and which our love will bring forth, much as the artist makes the statue appear from a block of stone. The soul we see in this way vibrates with our mere look of love. It awakens, it breaks its shell, it shines radiantly. For our human glance, when it is the vision of love, is also creative. Husbands and wives, fathers, mothers, and children should ask God to give them His eyes, as He promised a child, "I will place my eye in your heart." Then life will sing in the heart of your loved ones, and they will experience the exaltation which one of Mauriac's characters expresses: "I remember the thawing of my whole being under his look, my emotions springing up, myself liberated at the sources." The renewal of love. In chapter 14 of Saint Luke, Christ invites his hearers to a consideration of the need of sitting down together. Today, in a century of dizzying speeds, it is more necessary than ever to recall this need. I do not think it is an exaggeration to say that the best Christian couples, those who never omit the duty of kneeling down together, often omit the duty of sitting down together. Before setting out to establish a home and family, a couple reflects, ponders, considers, plans. But since they began doing it, have they ever sat down together to examine the progress, to rediscover the goal, to look again at the ideal, to consult with the master craftsman? I know the objections and the difficulties of stopping to make such an assessment, but I also know that a home can be a failure if some important things are not attended to.